Open Book was presented by Mario Frostrup and produced by Nicola Holloway.
Open water, clumps of trees, classical boathouse.
Lovely, the real England.
A comedy of ideas by Tom Stoppard.
English landscape was invented by gardeners, imitating foreign painters who were evoking classical authors.
Examining literature, mathematics, and landscape gardening.
Look, Capability Brown doing Claude, who was doing Virgil, Arcadia.
Arcadia by Tom Stoppard. Next week's feature-length Saturday play at 2:30 on BBC Radio 4.
We're back to this afternoon, and in just over half an hour's time, we've got File on 4. Against a background of escalating violence and a mounting death toll, the programme this week reports from Afghanistan. Former BBC correspondent in Kabul, Kate Clark, assesses claims of widespread corruption, from low-level bribery that affects daily life across the capital, to the widespread abuse of aid money that was supposed to help rebuild the country. Billions of dollars have gone in, but how much has actually been spent on reconstruction? And are people now becoming so disillusioned and cynical that they're losing faith in the government and its institutions? Kate Clark reports in File on 4, which you can hear in just over half an hour after the news at 5. Now, though, the Hollywood actor Robert Mitchum had a reputation for working hard and playing hard, but there was also a softer and secret side to his life, because the star of over 100 movies was also a poet. In Oh Dad, fellow poet Lloyd Robson goes on the trail of Mitchum in America.
Played around and I played around this old town too long. Summer's almost gone, winter's coming on.
Robert Mitchum, Big Bad Bob. Actor, singer, real-life roustabout, rogue meddler, recalcitrant felon, drug fiend, drunken pugilist, hobo, and all-round hunk. How they swooned in the aisles at the sight of him.
His chest arrives 10 minutes before he does. Just a great big, gorgeous man.
He had a way of walking that was just pure panther. I mean, it was this sensuous kind of thing that was also a little scary. And, you know, women love danger.
A wisecrack came very easily to Mitchum. He looked believable delivering it as well. he achieved what actors want to achieve, which is, it seems like I'm making this up on the spot, doesn't it? And in some cases, I actually think he was.
There's some people that you just are riveted to, but you don't know why. You know, there's something that happens inside of you, and he was that guy.
As a kid, when I watched Mitchum on screen, it forced me to accept what my father kept telling me, that I was a poor excuse for a male, just a skinny kid writing poems and poetries for girls, that I would never be a real man in Mitchum's image. So when I heard Mitchum, that rock from which the American male was carved, that man men wanted to be, was a secret writer of poetry, I had to go find his words. And find them I did, at least some of them. This is from a poem he wrote in his early 20s.
To Jones, around the bend, the quiet pool, where waters gather deep and cool and gentle, marks the melody and echoes softly then its tune. Mark then how the stone is ever adding harmony, gentle, pleasant. Mark it there forever. Softened voice to buffen the swirls.
Those who knew Mitchum personally knew something of the poet, yet not everything. Even to his grandson, the actor Bentley Mitchum, the poet and his stash of words were secret.
I became aware that he was a poet in the later years that I knew him, before he passed away. I didn't have much of an opportunity to see his poetry or read it. I understood from the family and my grandmother that he was very private about it, didn't show it to people. But I also heard that he had written much poetry.
In 1971, Mitchum appeared on American TV.
The Dick Cavett Show!
In a program entirely dedicated to Mitchum, the host attempted to draw the beast from his cave, to reveal the details of his poetic secret.
You write poetry,
well,
I know.
Yes. No, that's a canard. That's...
Oh, I've seen some of it.
Oh, really?
Well,
I'm sorry about that.
I won't pull it up, but you have written... Have you not sat down and written poem once or twice in your life?
I didn't expect it to leak out, though.
Will that hurt your image in any circles?
It's not that, no. You know, I did it sort of generally. It was sort of private, you know, and I'd throw it in a wastebasket and someone would retrieve it, you know, and blackmail me with it.
No, that's a canard. That quote never fails to make me laugh. It is Mitchum to the core. What Mitchum is really saying through using the word canard is that, yes, I am a man of literature, of words, but there's no way I'm going to admit it. And who can blame him? Mitchum grew up in a rough world during the American Depression, when to be anything less an all man was to leave himself open to attack. Oh, I'd like to claim the times have changed for young men writing poems.
I think the hard man image that you see on the screen is very much him in a lot of senses. He was very independent and very strong and very fearless in a lot of ways. But perhaps you have something there in saying that it was his way of balancing. You know, I think that all people have a soul. And it was his way of maybe expressing the softer side, and maybe that's why he didn't want people to see it, because maybe he saw that in a way as a weakness, which I think as he got older, he didn't want people to see it, because when he was younger, he was happy to put it out there much more.
In the early 1950s, Stanley Rubin produced one of the first ever movies to be filmed in CinemaScope, The River of No Return, starring Robert Mitchum and Marilyn Monroe. It's the tale of a man with a violent history, his young son, who learns his father is not all he thought he was, and a meddling saloon singer. For Rubin, Mitchum was the perfect choice to play the flawed, yet considerate, father.
I think the very fact that he had the outward appearance and some of the outward mannerisms of a fairly tough guy, and yet was an actor, there's the poetic side of Mitchum being expressed through acting, even though there were mannerisms in him and even a background of life in him that were the opposite of that. So the very fact that I thought he was the perfect guy to play the man in River of No Return also expresses what you could call a poetic side. One of the reasons I wanted Marilyn in River of No Return was that combined with her great sexuality, there was her vulnerability. And Mitchum was similar. He was a man's man, and yet he had this enormous affection and yearning for the reunion with his son. Even in the nature of his relationship with his son and the way he treated his son, there was a poetic side in the character, and therefore in Mitchum.
Mitchum grew up fatherless, and it was in his mother's home city of Bridgeport in Connecticut that his poetic talents were first recognized. The city's main newspaper, the Bridgeport Post, ran a three-column feature with photograph proclaiming the 8-year-old, flat-cap-wearing, pencil-toting little Bobby Mitchum a child prodigy.
Bridgeport has produced several youthful genii within the last few years who, starting from obscure beginnings, are now well on the road to fame. The latest of the budding geniuses to shine over the literary horizon of Bridgeport is Robert Mitchum, who is blossoming out as a youthful poet of much promise. Master Robert, who is a few months over 8 years of age, has, according to his mother, developed an extraordinary taste for writing. A glance over some of the products of this youthful brain indicates that here, perhaps, is a young poet who is gifted with original ideas.
Such sudden fame would not necessarily have pleased young Robert. He was, by all accounts, a shy loner in a blue-collar, snub-nosed town. And if all the other boys knew he was a poet, he might as well have had a target on his back. Ah, such are the challenges for the artistic and creative male. Yet, at least we have a record of his early writing, and it does show promise. This war poem illustrates an incredible understanding of assonance, alliteration, rhythm, and rhyme that you just would not expect from an 8-year-old.
A war poem. Through mud and snow I wander, pulling guns to save others' lives.
I fight in the mountains, yonder. I'm imprisoned in dusty dives. I seek adventure and find too much. Oh, if only I were rich. I'd not be in this terrible Dutch and fighting in this ditch.
As well as revealing an understanding of language and the musicality of words, the poem also reveals a level of unbelievably mature thought. I'm not referring to the anti-war sentiment, but to the line, I seek adventure and find too much. It's taken me almost 40 years to reach the same conclusion about my own life. Yet, continue to seek adventure Mitchum did.
When he was a little kid, like, he must have been 5, 6, 7, somewhere in there, he had disappeared from the house for the entire day. And everyone was looking everywhere for him, and they thought he'd run away, he'd run off. And they called the local police, and they couldn't find him anywhere. And finally, as the sun was setting, and the day was over, he came wandering back up the road towards the house. And everyone was like, oh my God, where have you been? What'd you run off? What did you do? And he just said, I wanted to see what was out there.
Mitchum's travels continued into his teens. With food and work scarce, he left home, jumped on a train, and became a hobo traveling the rails in search of the world, a job, an adventure. Far from home, he sent his mother a postcard. On it were written just 4 lines, making up one of Mitchum's most atmospheric poems.
Trouble lies in sullen pools along the road I've taken. Sightless windows stare the empty street. No love beckons me, save that which I've forsaken. The anguish of my solitude is sweet.
Even after his children had reached adulthood, Mitchum would frequently up sticks and vanish alone into the woods. It was an existence he was used to. Hollywood never erased the hobo. After his infamous drugs arrest in 1948, when everyone thought his career was over, Mitchum told the press, as far as he was concerned, he arrived in LA on a freight train and he would leave the same way. And there he is, Mitchum. Stroll in dusty streets, in lonely towns and hobo beats, in one-night stands and itchy feet and in that motion sound. A need to move, no need to hide, no limit set upon his mind. He trailed a whistle along the line to see what he could find. Matting the fur of feral dogs, drinking from the fetid bogs which rot between the sleeper logs and rumble out of town. Jumping boxcars weighed with risky life, learning ways of men and mice, and if he asked for anything of another guy, it was simply this. Hey, Dad, can you give me a light? And travelled on his way. In 1972, Mitchum appeared on the Michael Parkinson Show and reflected on his hobo life. Glamorous, it wasn't. Hungry, he was.
Knocking at the back door, asking the kind lady if she had a piece of bread, you know. Never offering to mow the lawn, just dealing with the kind lady.
This was travel without destination or goal.
Nothing really, just keep moving. No purpose. No purpose at all, really. I suppose that if I kept walking long enough, I'd fall across something. A warm body or something usable.
Still not 16, Mitchum was arrested in Georgia for vagrancy. He spent time on the chain gang before escaping through the swamp and returned home injured yet informed. In 1934, he and younger brother John, known as Jack, headed for California, yet John was arrested en route. Mitchum wrote to his sister and her husband, surreptitiously slipping in the news under the cover of poetic and musical language. Dear Nat and Ernie, so we're just lazing along, taking it easy, grabbed the wrong freight out of Birmingham and rode to New Orleans instead of Dallas. So I haven't been to Dallas for my dough. Perhaps Jack has, though. He left me in Lake Chaz, Louisiana. We'll grab a hot shot out of here tonight for El Paso. Write me in El Paso. Love, Bob. Mitchum, the real deal, rough and tumble, the hobo, the working class hero, has served as inspiration to numerous actors, writers, and musicians.
At night we ride the mansions of glory and suicide machines.
New Jersey's finest, one Bruce Springsteen, has written his fair share about roads and running. Was he a fan of Mitchum? Let's ask Jeanette Etheridge, owner of the Tosca Bar in San Francisco, where the ladies' room has become a shrine to Mitchum.
We're looking at the photos of Robert Mitchum in the ladies' room. And like I said, this is the first film he was in. That one is Out of the Past. What's that one? Is that the one that he was Heaven Knows Mrs. Allison? Or isn't that the one with Deborah Carr? And then that one, the last one, is a photo that Annie Leibovitz took.
Men's men in the ladies' room? Whatever next?
Sean Penn was playing pool with Bruce Springsteen back here. And Sean came over to me and he said, take Bruce Springsteen into the ladies' room. And I said, why? And he said, show him the Mitchum pictures. He's a big fan. And I said, you take him into the bathroom. I'm not going to take him in there. And he said, no, 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 I want you to take him in. So I said, Bruce, come with me. We went into the bathroom. And when we walked in, there was a woman who was washing her hands in the basin. I didn't pay any attention to her. I just started showing him the pictures, and he was, you know, going on about how great it was that, you know, we had this homage to Mitchum in the ladies' room. And when we left, I thought, this poor woman, nobody is ever going to believe that here she is in a bathroom in a bar and Bruce Springsteen walks in. And all he wanted to do was look at the pictures of Mitchum.
That his shrine should be in a restroom is more than fitting. Mitchum was once asked where his poems could be found. He replied, on restroom walls across the states. And a ladies' restroom in a bar? Well, that's just perfect. Here's Stanley Rubin again.
Mitchum could drink, and I experienced that in the making of River of No Return. He could drink most of a night, but, and I appreciated this, it never seemed to affect him at 7 o'clock the next morning. He was there. He was in makeup, wardrobe, and on the set on time, and he always knew his lines.
Mitchum liked to drink, yet it didn't seem to affect his health until much later in life. And even as a boozer, he kept in great shape. Polly Bergen appeared with Mitchum in Cape Fear. Both she and film critic David Thompson were bowled over.
Mitchum was really physically imposing and kept himself in great shape, always worked out, and was always, you know, really quite gorgeous to look at.
I remember, not that I wanted to kiss him, but when I met him, I thought, how does a woman kiss this man? How do they sort of get their face past the chest close enough to kiss him?
Mitchum had more than his fair share of admirers and was known to use his poetry to charm the women. One admirer, named Dorothy Spence, complained the women elbowed her out of the way to get to him. She was his childhood sweetheart and wife of 57 years.
Dorothy was everything to him when he was, gosh, 15 or 14 years old before he became anything. And he hopped the trains to go out to California to make something of himself. He told her, stick with me and you'll be farting through silk. And they stayed together for over 50 years, and she was. So he kept his word. He was able to look in the mirror and did what he said he was going to do.
I can only wonder about the depth of feeling that keeps two people together for so long. Surely Mitchum must have written hundreds of poems for his woman. Here's one.
Love song for Dorothy. With my shamed, sad hope in my telltale eyes, and the fleet fears trapped within my breast. There is no last mercy. There are no last lies. For my sweet dumb dreaming is confessed.
Women loved Mitchum, often in spite of themselves. But then there's nothing new about good girls falling for a bad boy. Mitchum could turn on the charm if he wanted to. But if he didn't, watch out. Novelist Edna O'Brien admitted that what attracted her to Mitchum wasn't necessarily any good for her.
I met an actor once, very briefly, called Robert Mitchum, who indeed is a very attractive man, and he said, "Why don't you comb your hair and look efficient?" And I knew that I liked him a lot.
Although fundamentally a loner, Mitchum also loved an audience and was a great raconteur. He could tell stories which left even the real-life protagonists wondering what happened next.
One time, my wife and I were in a restaurant in Colorado, and a fellow came over with a piece of soiled toilet tissue and threw it right down on top of my steak and said, "Sign that." And I said, "Of course." He picked up my fork and ran it right up through his chin, up into his upper palate, bent it over, said, "Take," ripped his pocket out and gave him the tab and said, "Take him to the hospital." There's been a dreadful accident here.
Although acting was always his second choice after writing, Mitchum realized early in his Hollywood career that poetry was not going to clothe the kids or feed the baby. Here's his grandson again.
He was a decent musician. He was a fighter for a while. I think that the reason he ended up going with the acting gig was because it paid better than being a poet. I mean, that's probably that's why he kept writing it, and as his success took off, he realized he could make much more money being an actor than a poet, and he could still write his poetry and keep it more of a private thing. But I agree with you, I think he had the talent to become a poet.
On one occasion, in 1982, Mitchum was drawn on his thoughts regarding his own poetry. His reply revealed little of what he kept secret, and an awful lot about why he kept it secret. He said, "I think the price of poetry is that it opens the door to more people than I have room for." The sensitive loner still remained. Here's a rare recording of Mitchum reading a poem. Sadly, not one of his own, although the subject matter is relevant. It's called Lonely Movies, and it's by Scott Richardson.
She got the part she always wanted, Juliet of the Nile. But when she turned to face the camera, her leading man was gone. He was gone with the wind and the rain, moved to another stage. Now she paces in her dressing room, rehearsing only rage. And every accident on her highway, every illusion her fear refines, keeps her freedom forever imprisoned until she shatters or until she finds her only lonely movies in her mind. She tried out for a brand new drama the night the earth stood still. But her makeup couldn't mask the scars each romance left behind. To have and yet not have everything her haunted heart desires, she tries in vain and cries out in pain to extinguish those old fires. And every accident on her highway, every illusion her fear refines, keeps her freedom forever imprisoned, until she shatters, or until she finds their only lonely movies in her mind. All her lonely movies have ended up the same. All her lonely movies fade out on the last frame. All her lonely movies have made her quite a star, a legend in the junkyard of this back lot where we are. And every accident on her highway, every illusion her fear refines, keeps her freedom forever imprisoned until she shatters or until she finds their only lonely movies in her mind.
The one and only Frank Sinatra once said of Mitchum that he knew more about music than anyone else outside of the professional world of musicians and composers. Mitchum's reply? Well, that goes to show how much Sinatra knows about music.
They said, "Take this advice from me, Bobby, and go back to the West Indies. What you need is
drink the coconut water."
Mitchum owned a huge record collection and recorded a few albums himself. He introduced mainstream America to the sounds of calypso. He recorded Little Old Wine Drinker Me before handing it over to Dean Martin. He wrote the songs for the movie Thunder Road. He frequently sang in his movies, and he blew a mean saxophone. In fact, his love of jazz stayed with him throughout his life, as did his use of the hepcat terms of his youth, as in, "Oh, Dad, that man sure blows a mean horn."
Coconut water.
Film noir expert Eddie Muller saw it shining on the screen in Mitchum's performances.
I've always kind of thought of him as a bit of a jazz player on screen, you know, which certainly has its poetic aspects as well.
Although Mitchum's reputation is that of a rebel who sleepwalked through his films, many within Hollywood saw him as the consummate actor. Mitchum's problem was he brought realism to the screen before the audience wanted it, and that he made it look far too easy.
For certain roles that he played, I think he achieved a sort of perfection, which is an actor understanding exactly what the intention of the material is and being able to convey it with the utmost minimum of effort, which some people denigrate. At the time, of course, a lot of critics felt that acting was big acting. And that isn't what you got with Mitchum. What you got with Mitchum was you witnessed being. I mean, he knew how to just completely absorb all of that and just be that on the screen. He says, "This is what you want? Here it is." Which is a gift.
Mitchum was a legendary actor who worked for the elite directors and alongside the greatest stars. His reputation was even larger than his accomplishment. But was this reputation justified?
From what I can tell, most of the legends about Mitchum had a basis in fact, definitely. The brawl with Primo Carnera at the Formosa Cafe, validated by many people I've spoken with. You have to appreciate guys back then who could live that large life and for a long time.
Larger than life, he certainly was. Enough time to write a lot of poetry, even if it was in secret. His grandson gives little away.
I believe they're at my grandmother's house. She probably has them in a folder. I mean, jokingly, they said they're behind the couch, but I've looked behind the couch and they're not there. But I'm sure she has some. And when the day comes that she eventually passes, maybe we'll unearth. It'd be wonderful to find this library of poetry. Hopefully it's there somewhere. And then we can get even more insight to this man's mind and his soul.
Well, perhaps one day they'll let me rummage through their attic. Mileman's dead now, so I can't rub his face in the fact that real men also write poems. Yet what Mitchum still offers me is an example of how a man can claim both sides of himself. How he can be one of the gang and a loner. A drunken womanizer and an honest expresser of love and dedication. How he can be foul-mouthed or vulgar, and sensitive or considerate. And that neither extreme makes him complete. That's what makes Mitchum so fascinating. So now that I, as a poet, have Mitchum to help me combat my father's ignorant opinions, perhaps it is finally time I stepped out of everyone else's shadows and traveled on my own. Take care, you poet man, Robert Mitchum. I may meet you again in the streets and swamps ahead. Until then, I raise my pen to you and a half-full glass. Just remember, it's your round next.
O'Dad was presented by Lloyd Robson and produced by John Gower. O'Dad is a Boomerang production for BBC Radio 4. Take a few large fields, add music, people and rain, and you have Glastonbury. There are over 177,000 people there this weekend, including Giles Wembley Hogg.
I don't know why you want to go to Glastonbury anyway. It'll be rubbish and you'll hate it.
No, I won't. Been to loads of festivals. I'm actually really into that scene, you know. Festa did last summer was carnage, an absolute riot.
What festival?
Glyndebourne.
Giles Wembley-Hogg goes off to Glastonbury this Tuesday evening at 6:30.
BBC Radio 4, the news at 5 o'clock.